This episode of Legion of News is made possible by our friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News!
From high atop the Milkpacking District in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon, this, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all-important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
A crazy actor kills his mother with a samurai sword. Scientists discovered flying snakes, and a storm hits the Pacific Northwest, which freaks everyone out.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, pay heed! For this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon, I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Tuesday, November 23rd, 2010. The current storm that hit the Pacific Northwest and other western states has dumped heavy snow on roads, knocked out power to tens of thousands of people, and caused a cargo plane to overshoot its runway in Seattle. At least three deaths have been blamed on the storm, including a man struck and killed outside his car Monday night on snowy Interstate 5 in Tacoma. Washington State Patrol Trooper Brandy Kessler said it wasn't clear whether the man was chaining up his car or pushing it when he was hit. Snow and blizzard warnings across Washington and Idaho's panhandle were ending this morning, but frigid air will drop tonight to the single digits in western Washington and as much as 15 degrees below zero in eastern Washington, according to the National Weather Service.
I don't mean to be this guy right out of the gate, but was there actual snow where he was chaining up his car? I mean actual snow.
I have no idea.
Okay.
Well, it said snowy Interstate 5 in Tacoma,
yeah, but
so I'm saying there was probably snow.
I wonder if that was... I guess technically there was snow here last night, too, but, I mean, it wasn't really snow. I mean, it wasn't snow of any demonstrable amount or appreciable...
North of us, they're getting real snow. In Seattle, there's actual snow.
All right. This is my squint of cynicism.
There really is.
Okay. I'm not saying it's not the case. I'm just saying, I'm a little skeptical about these things in the Northwest.
Seattle's morning rush hour saw a few cars on the icy roads and motorists driving slowly. Most schools in the state were closed or delayed, and the University of Washington closed all three of its campuses. Snow plows and de-icing trucks were at work across the state. Officials in Seattle have urged people to stay home, and many highways are dangerous to travel. Alaska Airlines warned that a number of its flights were being delayed or canceled out of Seattle-Tacoma International Airport.
It's the best holiday week ever.
It is. It's the most wonderful time. Temperatures dipped to freezing here in Portland last night, and homeless people lined up at the emergency warming shelters. Some schools are closed, but Portland International Airport is open, and flights are operating normally. So, Oregon State Police said heavy snow, high winds, and limited visibility caused numerous commercial trucks to jackknife Monday in the area around Mount Hood and sections of Highway 26 were closed intermittently.
By the way, can I just say that if your school is closed, you're soft. I am speaking to anybody inside the greater Portland area right now whose school was closed. Not that you don't appreciate it. And, you know, and look, Rick Emerson is not a Scrooge. I enjoy a respite from the enslavement of the state, you know, just as much as the next person. But I'm saying if your school is trying to peddle some nonsense to you that it's just impassable, the roads, no one can get anywhere today. You're being raised to be a soft, gelatinous mold in the shape of a human. I mean, there's just no getting around that fact.
I got here from Tualatin.
Yeah, also, there's no snow anywhere.
No.
So, you know, I'm just. This is why we're going to be prime fodder for our invaders from the east, Don.
I mentioned something about the weather on Facebook, and my mother-in-law did the whole mother-in-law thing and said, I grew up in the gorge, and we would get feet of snow in the wintertime, and we would laugh at people in Portland when they said their schools were closed, because our schools weren't closed.
And the thing is, sometimes that laughter is justified. That's the thing. You know, you'd say, nobody likes the guy who sits around, you know, because I had the mom who, for reasons that have never really been fully explained, lived in Death Valley at one point, which you think you wouldn't live there because it's called Death Valley. And that's sort of nature's way and man's way of telling you, you know, hey, it's 126 degrees, you should live somewhere else. So nobody likes being around that person either. By the same token, this is just why the rest of the country mocks us openly sometimes. Yeah. Is because there's a quarter inch of snow and suddenly people are like, do you have any chains? Well, you were actually saying that you were going to, you know, you're going to go to Fred Meyer and get the de-icing thing for your lock, which is a little forward thinking so you can be prepared the next time this comes. No one else will be that prepared. Everybody else will wait until it's January. Then they will be over-preparing, and they'll all do it at the same time. They'll all go in and demand studded snow tires from Les Schwab so they can make it through, you know, like the fraction of an inch of ice that is, them on their five-block trip to work.
Well, I had the interesting sort of, logic puzzle this morning with cars, in that one car, the locks were all frozen, so we couldn't get into the car. The other car wouldn't, you could get into it because it has the electronic thing that you just push the button.
Was that not working, though, the
electronic
thing?
No, that worked fine, but the car wouldn't turn over.
Ah,
the engine wouldn't start.
I see.
So then I finally, I came out later and the locks were still frozen on the one car, but the other car started. So I'm like, hooray, I can go to work. And then I realized there's like frozen crap all over the windshield. And I go, okay, I'll have to get the scraper. The scraper's in the glove compartment of the other car,
but
the locks are frozen closed.
It's like you're inside a puzzle in which you are leaving Chicago at 15 miles an hour. That's fantastic. All right.
A deranged martial arts student, after delivering a terrifying religious rant, savagely killed his mother with a samurai sword inside her Brooklyn apartment, police said. Suspect Michael Brea, 31, an actor who once appeared on TV's Ugly Betty, angrily screamed at his doomed parent to repent before delivering the death blows after horrified neighbors called for police.
Didn't really sound like she was given the proper opportunity to follow his instructions.
Neighbor Gregory Clare, 25, lives one floor below the apartment where Yannick Brea was brutally slain, said, I heard this wild screaming. Michael was yelling, repent, repent, sinner, sinner, over and over again. He was screaming, you never accepted Jesus. It was real loud. Yannick Brea, 55, yelled for help, but that didn't arrive in time to save her. Michael Brea was spouting gibberish when he was removed from the Park Place apartment on a stretcher, neighbors said. He was taken to Kings County Hospital for psychiatric evaluation after his arrest. Neighbors said splattered blood was visible on the apartment windows.
Okay. The idea that he was demanding that she repent Jesus while killing her with a sword, you know.
A samurai sword.
Associated with Japan is sort of interesting. All right. People never really think these things through. The internal logic always seems to escape them at the crucial moment. Hello, friends and neighbors. You are listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. It is Tuesday, November 23rd, 2000. And for no reason at all, I almost just said Tuesday, November 23rd, 1996. I don't know why.
Was it especially cold and snowy in November? Are you flashing back in time?
It's possible. I suppose that maybe this is part of an ongoing mental breakdown of some kind that I'm having, in which case the rest of the show might be even more entertaining than it already is.
Are you coming unstuck in time like Billy Pilgrim? That's a Kurt Vonnegut reference.
Yeah, I got nothing.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us here at Cascadia.fm. This program is available via iTunes later on today, as well as a direct MP3 download here or at legionofnews.com. Coming up slightly after 1 o'clock, we'll have the Rick Emerson Show over at rickemerson.com. Later on this hour, we'll have entertainment news and science on the march. This is Don Taylor.
An annual holiday spending survey finds Americans plan to spend more this holiday season. Oh, we read this yesterday.
Yes.
I thought this was a different one.
No.
Well, screw that. We don't care about the holiday spending. Wasn't there another one of those in here?
I think we've had multiple stories about holiday spending that have come across the transom, all indicating that we have no money, but that we're going to spend it anyway.
This is the one I thought that the other one was. The majority of Americans planning to shop on Black Friday plan to spend between $100 and $500 on that day alone, according to a new Nielsen survey.
Awesome.
Nielsen Vice President James Russo says the results show consumers want deals.
Consumers are focused on those value channels, and by the value channels, we talk about super centers and club stores and even dollar stores to some extent.
Is that the, let me ask you this. When you see a car that has the I'm with, it's not the I'm with Sam, that's a Sam Adams thing, but the, isn't there like a, you see cars occasionally that have a sticker that indicates that it's like a member of like a Sam's Club?
Not for a long time, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I saw one of those yesterday driving up, it was driving the street in front of my house, and I had that whole moment where I realized that someone had actually taken the time to obtain and then affix a bumper sticker identifying them as a patron of Walmart.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, one doesn't like to be a snob about these things, but you do have to wonder exactly what goes on in your head. Like, if that is such a crucial part of your identity that it needs to be emblazoned on your jalopy so that everyone can see it.
Maybe he was confused, and what he meant to say was that he's a friend of Bill W.
Oh, that's entirely possible. Okay.
Bill, Sam.
All right.
Bill. Russo says...
Bill's Club. It's just a huge supercenter of booze.
No, it's nothing but coffee and donuts, because it's all for people who go to
shame.
AA meetings. Coffee, donuts, cigarettes, and shame. Russo has more details on how much most plan... What?
Oh, what?
He has more details on how much most plan on spending.
It's kind of interesting in this recessionary environment that we're stuck in that approximately 61% of those that are planning to shop are looking to spend in the range of $100 to $500 specifically on Black Friday.
That is interesting.
Yeah, in a really, like, people are stupid kind of a way.
The great thing about the name Black Friday is it doesn't matter what kind of economic conditions we have, the name is appropriate. It's sort of a, it's like a Rorschach name, just from year to year. You know, because it was, wasn't the whole thing that it was originally because that was the day that shopkeepers got into the black?
Well, see, and I always thought, I first heard that when I was like a kid, and I always thought it meant that it was like
the worst day
to go shopping because everyone was out.
See, so maybe that's the thing. Maybe that was, maybe it's not even, it had to do with financial conditions. Maybe it's just depending on one's outlook. Because it's like, you talk to people who work in retail, and they've all got, last year, I think it was Richie Bristol, I think his sister worked at like Nordstrom or something like that, and it was like, and they told her that she had to get to work at 3 a.m. Because the store opens at, I swear to Christ, 4:30 a.m. or at least it did last year. So that was their, you know, their big holiday push began at 4:30 a.m. And it's like, and don't get me wrong, Rick Emerson is a fan of rampant commercialism and consumerism. I own many shiny gewgaws of my own. But I don't really feel compelled to get out of bed at 4 a.m. so I can stand outside the gate, you know, like Dawn of the Dead, like waiting for the thing to go up.
No.
But she was having to get to work at like 3 and 3:30 a.m. every Black Friday. So if that is your job, I would imagine that you have a rather dim outlook on humanity and how you're going to be spent. And plus, the other thing is, it's not like I'm a big fan of Thanksgiving to begin with, but that must make you hate Thanksgiving like to a far greater degree than you would anyway. Because Thanksgiving now is just this big starting gun for the worst period of your life.
Yeah.
You know, for this 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, probably all the way up until Christmas Eve, where you were just surrounded by people, like demanding that you find them fistfuls of baubles and like thrusting coupons at you. It just must be a living hell on earth.
Well, no, I worked at Starbucks that one year when the holidays came around, and everyone in the world was getting days off. But it was like, you know, no, Starbucks is open because, yeah, you know, people want their coffee on their way to go to grandma's, and people want their coffee on their way to, like, go shopping for Black Friday. So Thanksgiving and the day after Thanksgiving, I was there opening the store at 5:30 a.m.
Jesus.
And yeah, just wanted to just kill myself.
Do not want.
So this guy also says that top on consumers' holiday shopping list is apparel, followed by electronics.
The one area where consumers were not cutting back in this tough, difficult environment was in the consumer electronics space. So we really want that, you know, next generation of cell phone, that 3D TV, that iPad e-reader, and so on.
So you want to be able to have the even larger television on which you can see Ali Velshi telling you how you're not going to have a job.
Every year, every couple of years, there's a study that gauges people's perceptions of the difference between need and want. What is a necessity,
right,
and what is a luxury? And over the last, 20 years, they've shown this, this constant, steady shift from people realizing that a car was a luxury to saying a car is a necessity. People saying that a microwave oven is a luxury. And now people saying a microwave oven is a necessity.
Well, that's true, though. There's no getting around that.
The people saying that a television is a necessity, that a home computer is a necessity. And the fact is, for most people, it really isn't. But we have this perception that we absolutely have to have these things. And they have to be big, and they have to be shiny, and they have to be new, and they have to be the very, very best. And it's kind of terrifying, really, when nobody has any money.
Whatever happened to a microwave with a dial on the front of it? All I need is an on button. What's a popcorn setting anyway? All right.
When I was a kid,
I
had a wagon and a stick.
I have,
and that's all I needed.
I have nowhere to go beyond the dial and the popcorn setting. That's the extent of my microwave humor.
So a man who claims that he was involved in the murder-for-hire plot that we discussed the other day, Connie Anderson, planning to kill her ex-husband, Kip. This man says that he was given $150 for a gun and about $100 to kill the ex-husband of
About $100.
Yeah.
Does that mean that she just had a coin jar or something?
Well, I got $98.78.
And I got a 2-for-1 here at Red Lobster. So just picture her standing in front of that Coinstar thing, like at Safeway, just sort of, dumping, nah, that's a button, damn it.
Well, the police say they arrested Connie Anderson after she agreed to pay an undercover officer for the slaying.
$150 for a gun? Where was he supposed to go to get this gun?
I have no idea. The man who asked not to be identified says he did offer to beat up Anderson's ex-husband, but he was shocked when she said she didn't care how he was killed. She just wanted him dead.
I'm picturing her just sort of dumping it out and kind of doing that thing of just like the guy in front of you at the plaid pantry who's got to buy some cigarettes, but he's just brought a sandwich bag full of coins, and he dumps it out and he's doing the 2, 3, 350, and then he gets down to the pennies and he's doing the 360, 370, 375, 380, and that she wants the guy killed, and she wants the gun. And she's operating in, some 1927 pricing structure where she can get it all taken care of for, $212.
Right.
And the guy's just looking and going, I can yell at him a little bit and maybe break one of his fingers for this, but you're really not going to get much beyond that.
I could punch him in the shoulder.
So
that's what you get.
And she wanted him to go buy his own gun for the crime with the $150.
Right.
Which, look, for all I know, it's not like I'm some criminal mastermind or something. I am not a thug for life. So I don't really know if that's a price, for which one can expect to reasonably obtain a gun. Maybe it is. I guess maybe it's a who-you-know kind of a thing.
I don't think so, though.
Yeah,
I'm not sure you can get one that actually works.
Let me ask you this right now. Do you own a gun?
Not currently.
Okay. So if it's the gun that you had, is that still within, could you obtain that? In other words, you had a gun at one point. Could you get that gun, or is that gun gone?
No,
is that
gun
lost
is gone.
To you?
We sold,
okay.
We sold guns.
If you had to get a gun, I don't know, by tomorrow at the same time, by tomorrow at noon, if you had to get a gun to really, give a guy what for, do you feel like you'd be able to do that? If it was going to be used for something nefarious, I don't mean you're going to borrow it from your friend Chet and give it back to him.
Yeah, see, I could. I could get a gun. The thing is that I don't know if the person I would get the gun from might ask a lot of questions as to what I was going to use
for. See, that's what I'm saying,
if I just said something like, I'm going to go to the range and do some target shooting, he'd probably say, oh, okay.
What if it was a gun that you had to, that you weren't going to get back?
That could be problematic.
If I said you got to get a gun and, it can't be traced to you, and at the end you're going to throw it in the river.
Yeah, you need, at least $300-$400 for that.
And see, I don't think I know anybody who could get that from...
No, and even then there's the waiting period. You'd have to go to a gun show. You'd have to find, a gun show when there's one at the expo center or something, so that you're buying directly from a private party.
See, that's the thing, is you either need a gun show or you just need to know a guy who can get you a gun.
Yeah.
And I always wonder about people who know a guy who can get you a gun, because that indicates... This is why sometimes, though I embrace our system of law and justice here in this country, occasionally it's why people are just guilty. Because if you know a guy who can just get you a gun, that no one's going to ask any questions about, that indicates that you have traveled in some nefarious circles in your life already, which means you probably have a predilection for crime. I mean, that's just my assessment. Because, right, that's like, if you told me to go buy some crack. I mean, I'm not saying I don't know people who smoke crack. The law of averages indicates I probably know several of them. But, that's more of an at-home activity.
Yeah.
With the blinds drawn kind of a thing. So I don't think I would really know.
Well, the whole budget murder plot didn't really out well for Connie Anderson. Because now she's charged with attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and solicitation of murder. And her bail is set at $80,000. So, you know, if she just bet a little bit more.
Don't skimp. Now, if you try to save money on the end, it always bites you at the outcome of that. It just comes back on you.
Jurors have convicted Ingmar Gwandik of 2 counts of first-degree murder in the 2001 death of Washington intern Chandra Levy. Legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin says the defense had a legitimate case.
The defense here was really a classic reasonable doubt defense. There is just not enough evidence connecting this defendant to the crime, and I don't know if the jury will agree to it, but it's not an implausible defense here.
You know, it's one of those things where Gary Condit is just sitting at home on his couch going, convict, 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 just so he can move on with his, you know, as weird or as sleazy as that guy may have been. And I don't know. I mean, that is a thing where I only know, everything I know about the Chandra Levy case just came through, like, sort of the prejudicial keyhole of the mainstream media where they found out that she was getting boned by Gary Condit. And then that became the entire story. And so, yeah. Therefore, you know, he must be guilty of killing her or whatever, which I think is what caused me to, you know, he just... I can't even remember if he ran for another term or if he just opted out.
I think he did. I think he just...
I think he might have just...
Just
pulled the ripcord and, F it, I'll stay home. And then just whatever. But his entire thing, you know, got derailed because of her. And then everybody just immediately leapt to, because it was not too long after the OJ thing, I think. It was like sort of in a recently post-OJ world, and then it turns out it was just like some gardener, you know, just some guy. I mean, if this is a guy who did it, it was just, you know, some angry drifter.
I remember when this happened, and I thought, wow, you know, if he didn't do it.
It's the worst timing.
That is the worst luck ever.
The worst luck on earth. And here's the other thing about Chandra Levy. Chandra Levy is one of those people, and you could probably think of 2 or 3 more examples of this right off the top of your head, where you don't really know what they look like. You only know what they look like in one specific photo, which has been chosen to represent them in all media. The only photograph I've ever seen of her is where she's got the curly black hair and she's got that weird wife beater tank top thing on. And she's sitting, like, leaning, looking hot, by the way. So, I mean, I can, you know, I can see the appeal there. It's like the one shot of Monica Lewinsky in the beret, which was the only thing we ever saw of her for years and years.
Well, Toobin also points out the case was based solely on circumstantial evidence.
It's based, in its most powerful part, on the fact that this defendant attacked 2 women in almost the same place, in almost the same way that Chandra Levy was attacked. But there's no eyewitness, there's no DNA evidence.
Well, I read them. Yeah. So there you go.
So again, it could just be horrible luck for this guy, too.
She was bad luck, that dame. She was bad news, friend.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy is known for his temper. And at an off-the-record briefing, a group of lucky journalists got a firsthand taste of his dirty mouth. When asked whether he had used money from a Pakistani arms deal to fund a political campaign, Sarkozy blew up at reporters, calling the allegations crazy and unbelievable, before directing his anger toward the press corps and accusing them all of being pedophiles.
I'm sorry.
At first, Sarkozy singled out a random journalist and, and began railing at him.
You are a pedophile.
Exactly. And you. I have no evidence against you, but it would seem you're a pedophile. Who told me? I have an absolute conviction. I've seen the intelligence reports, but I won't tell you which ones. I've seen someone, but I won't tell you who, and it was word of mouth. But I have an absolute conviction that you're a pedophile. Can you explain yourself? He then launched into a 10-minute tirade against the rest of the journalists before leaving the room with the sign-off, "See you tomorrow, pedophile friends."
Wow, that's like the world's worst television host signing off his show for the day. Oh, my God. Oh, that's fantastic. I'm so glad I hadn't heard anything about that before I came in today. Oh, wow. Please tell me it's on film somewhere. Like, it wouldn't be in English, though. Oh,
no,
it's too bad.
No, it wouldn't. But I'm sure... Well, the thing is, they said it was an off-the-record briefing. So I guess it was one of those things where probably there were no cameras or anything. So he felt like it was okay to see.
Except there's like 100 reporters in the room.
Yeah.
Oh,
going,
man.
Going click on their digital recorders in their pocket the minute he starts to...
That is fantastic. That's awesome. Good for him. Well done.
Yeah. After denouncing Facebook as a threat to marriage, New Jersey pastor Cedric Miller has come under fire for his own risque past. Last week, the head of the Living Word Christian Fellowship Church became a media sensation by blaming the site for his congregation's marital problems, demanding the church officials erase their accounts or risk their jobs. Married couples are going on Facebook, and what happens can end up in my office, Miller said of his experience in marital counseling. I know from where we stand in the Christian perspective, the connection is inappropriate. But while Miller was sermonizing against Facebook, New Jersey's Asbury Park Press was digging into the pastor's own history, specifically testimony he gave in a 2003 criminal case in which he admitted to having a three-way relationship with his wife, his male assistant, and on occasion, the assistant's wife.
Okay.
We would talk and laugh and play and just beyond what was appropriate, Miller testified.
Talk and laugh and play.
He then later clarified that, yes, they had all slept together.
That was also the effing, really.
Addressing his congregation yesterday, Miller dismissed the story as old news, but acknowledged that it was shocking. This was resolved at that time, and accordingly, we will not allow it to detract from our mission at hand to save as many marriages as we can.
Awesome. Good for you. I like guys who just, you know, there's something about those guys who just have this so much chutzpah that they just, you know, like they acknowledge the horrific thing, but then they just barrel right past it, you know? Our friend Bruno Sarkozy, who then goes right to the, and you're all pedophiles! You're listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget the Rick Emerson, the radio program, comes up a little bit later on today, shortly after 1 o'clock at rickemerson.com. Rickemerson.com. Did you watch Walking Dead?
I did indeed.
Caught up. All right, so we'll talk Walking Dead day late, but we'll get to Walking Dead. We'll talk... We got Dexter coming up. Mm-hmm. I will discuss that because now the finish line is within sight. That's the great thing about Dexter is that with Walking Dead, which I didn't realize only 6 episodes.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I thought it was they were in the full 13.
I thought so as
but
well.
But they're doing the Breaking Bad thing where it's 6 the first season, then I guess the 13 or whatever the season after that.
Then they wait a year and hope everyone's still interested.
Walking what?
Zombies are so last year.
So they don't get V'd. Anyway, so that's coming up a little bit after 1 o'clock today. That is the Rick Emerson radio program. You are listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm, brought to you by, among other folks, our fine friends at Squires Electric. You can find out more about them by going to SquiresElectric.com. That is SquiresElectric.com. And they've been in Portland for over a decade. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical contractors, which means that if you've got some sort of an issue, if you've got some sort of a boggle at your home in terms of electricity, whether you've got a power that needs to be taken into a different room, maybe a room you've added onto the house, maybe you've remodeled, maybe your business is moving into a different building and you realize that the Ethernet wiring is just not sufficient. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier because, as Don Taylor found out this morning, you appreciate things that work, and you don't really think about them until the moment they do not work, and then suddenly you say, "Gah!" and you realize how little knowledge you have about how to fix certain things. Like, for example, when you go to turn, you go to turn your car, and it just doesn't turn over; it just sits there, mm-hmm. and you realize that you have. Like, there is no plan B there, right? I mean, it's like you have no alternate route. You just sort of because you've always just turned the key and the thing has just started. And it's not like you can just sweet-talk the thing or you can just sort of coax it, you know, or you can,
Although one tries.
One tries. Come on, baby.
You're the best car ever. Come on. Come on. Do this for me.
One more time for Dawn. And it's just, it doesn't really have the desired outcome most of the time. But if that happens to your home, whether it comes to, when it comes to power, when it comes to, installing a new piece of equipment, whether it's, a washer, whether it's a dryer, and you realize it's far more complicated than you anticipated, even something like a ceiling fan, which, as if we've noted in the past, is a thing that they always sort of pedal off onto you as, like, only needing, some paper clips and, and positive thought to attach to the ceiling. It is more complicated than that sometimes. So everything from that to constructing an entire building a brand-new condominium from the ground up, which they actually just finished, Squires Electric can take care of all your electrical needs from top to bottom, A to Z, nuts all the way back to soup. 503-252-1609 is the phone number for Squires Electric. 503-252-1609 or go to SquiresElectric.com. Squires.com. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier. Squires Electric.com. Here is Don Taylor.
Let's do our science news.
Awesome. Here is your science on the march for Tuesday, right here at Legion of News.
The worst nightmare for people with a phobia of snakes may have just been realized. Scientists have captured footage of flying snakes, explaining how five related snake species stay airborne for up to 79 feet. The acrobatic arboreal snakes, all of the genus Chrysopelea, use what's known as gliding flight to sail from tree to tree in their Southeast and South Asia habitats. The new research presented at the American Physical Society Division of Fluid Dynamics meeting in Long Beach explains how the snakes accomplish their seemingly improbable feat. The snake isn't defying gravity or doing something out of the blue, said project leader Jake Socha. It's the magnitude of the forces that are somewhat surprising. Given that this is a snake and its cross-sectional body shape is more like a blunt shape than a typical streamlined wing, we wouldn't have expected such good aerodynamic performance. Socha, a Virginia Tech biologist, and his team launched the flying snakes from an over 49-foot tower and then recorded the snakes' every move in the finest details.
You know, please tell
me... So they were tossing snakes from a tower and filming them.
Please tell me that as they do this, that the snake makes some sort of a ch-ch-ch-ch-ch sound as it leaps from one tree to another. I look at nothing!
The scientists whose work has been accepted for publication in the journal Bioinspiration and Biomimetics, which is quite a great read, by the way, next developed a mathematical model to explain how the snakes use gliding flight to travel over such long distances. The snakes create lift using a combination of its flattened cross-sectional shape and the angle that it takes to the oncoming airflow, known as the angle of attack. To take off from a tree branch, for example, the snakes will drop the front of their bodies to create a J-shaped loop before jumping and accelerating upwards. That motion hurls the snake into the air. Then the airborne snakes, however, never reach an equilibrium gliding state when the forces generated exactly counteract the force pulling them down. They just didn't immediately fall to the ground either. Instead, the snake is pushed upward, even though it is moving downward, because the upward component of the aerodynamic force is greater than the snake's weight.
You know, you just know that they're making a military application out of this, and here's how you know. Because there would be no other reason to spend time... It's not like they're trying to figure out how to make snakes fly, now don't get me wrong, that would be great. It would be like figuring out how to make a flying goat or something, you know? Like just taking a thing that can't fly now, you know, just, what's this? Well, it's a hamster. Well, we're going to give it wings. You know, that would be sort of great. But the thing is already able to, I mean, if not fly, I mean, it can get great distances, you know, while airborne. So it's not like it's a problem that needs solving. Like,
no.
It's solved, as Clouseau would say. Like, you know, they've got it taken care of. Probably had it taken care of 100 million years before we were here. It's just that we want to make something else fly that isn't previously doing it. And by something else, we mean, you know, like some sort of, you know, super commanding militaristic cyborg that we're going to give, like, sort of big flappy side sections to.
Or snakes filled with nanobots and plastic explosives.
This guy, by the way, we get a message, says, hey, did you know the mascot of the high school in Fort Lauderdale is the Flying Cobras? Said, I always thought they were making things up. Yes, followed by the obligatory snakes, that you don't need the plane, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, there you go.
Israeli archaeologists have discovered a swimming pool in which a legion of Roman soldiers bathed after sacking Jerusalem and expelling the Jews from their city.
It does wear a body out.
It does. That's tiring, the sacking. Featuring a number of plastered bathtubs and a pipe on its side used to fill it with water, the pool was part of a larger complex, which included bathhouses and more swimming pools. Hundreds of terracotta roof tiles found on the white industrial mosaic floor indicate that the pool was a covered structure. The tiles bore the mark Leg XFR for 10th Legion Fratensis, and surprisingly, the paw prints of a dog that probably belonged to one of the soldiers. The print could have happened accidentally or have been intended as a joke, excavation director Ofer Sion said in a statement. Based in Jerusalem for about 200 years, the 10th Legion Fratensis consisted of about 6,000 soldiers. It was responsible for the brutal destruction of Jerusalem's Second Temple in 70 AD. And the repression of the Jewish revolt in 132 AD. Sion said, it seems the bathhouse was used by these soldiers who were garrisoned there after suppressing the Bar Kokhba rising in 135 AD when the pagan city was established.
They found that just, you know, that a whole day of oppressing Jews just really put a strain on, like, your biceps or your trilats or something. And so you had to have the appropriate, had to get a mineral rubber.
And men need to get naked together and sit around in hot water.
And have boys rub you with soft Turkish towels, Dawn.
Mm-hmm. I'll just think about that for a moment.
I just waited for the music there so I could punctuate.
A pastor says he has evidence that an 8-meter crocodile lurks in the river at Queensland's Gulf County. Pastor Elton Thompson said he took pictures of slide marks from the crocodile last Wednesday on the Norman River. I haven't actually seen the crocodile, but it was the slide marks that it left behind, he said. He took his measuring tape down to the bank. Its paw print spanned 25 centimeters, and some claw marks went into the mud 2.5 centimeters deep.
I didn't hear anything.
No. They're predicting that the crocodile is 1.5 to 2 meters across its girth, which means that it could be as long as 8 meters long.
Across its girth?
Yes, across its...
1.5 to 2 meters across its girth, that would be...
Wide. Its width.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I know what girth means. But I'm just saying that would be like 5 feet across.
Yeah, and then...
That doesn't seem plausible. It seems like you can't have a... That's... That would be like this. That would be... That would be...
Well, and there's a replica of a crocodile.
Unacceptably large, I think.
That's the whole point. There's a replica in this town of an 8.64 meter crocodile shot in the area in the 1950s, and they have a plaster statue of it. So that's ostensibly how big the crocodile is that may be lurking about.
Jesus. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, its head is the size of a car.
I actually don't... I was really just literally rendered speechless just now. I actually couldn't even... Wow. Okay, I'm just going to put that... No, I'm going to hand that back to you. I don't even want to see that. That's gigantic.
That's gigantic.
Right, there you go. You're listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget the Rick Emerson Show comes up later on the day, a little bit after 1 p.m., and this very fine program is available via your mobile device at mobile.cascadia.fm. That is mobile.cascadia.fm. .fm. Here is Dawn Taylor.
That's all of the science.
Excellent. There you go. There's your science on the march for Tuesday, November 23rd, 2010. You are listening to Legion of News, brought to you by, among other folks, our brand new business partner, ChristmasMountainTrees.com. It's just like it sounds. I'll give you the website for that right up front here. ChristmasMountainTrees.com. It's a third-generation family farm and a full-time farm, and this is what they do. This is their bailiwick. It's in their wheelhouse. They grow and care for Christmas trees year-round, as opposed to somebody who's just which we've all done. You've all gone and you stood at the lot, and you sit there. And if you go to the Christmas tree lot, it's like in front of some big box store. It's like downtown next to a falafel stand or something. You're just standing there and you're walking, and there's only like the same. It's like when you would go to a video store, like at a 7-Eleven or something back in the 1980s, or it's like you'd stop. There was this rule in about 1989 where every business that was open for more than an hour a day also had to stock videos. So, like, you know, you would just, like, be stopping to get a snow cone, and then there would be a guy that had the selection of, like, 12 VHS tapes right there. And you would go there on a Friday night because the lines, you know, were just sort of unacceptably long everywhere else, and you would sit there and you would look at the 12 VHS tapes, and you would say, all right, okay, do I want Fatso starring Dom DeLuise, or do I want this Jane Fonda workout tape? I don't want either of these. All right, I'll come back later. And then you would go wander around the store, you'd come back later, and you go, okay, do I want the Jane Fonda workout tape, or do I want Killdozer 3? I don't want either of these. And there would just be and you would just sit there hoping that the selection would somehow magically get larger, and it never did. And you just felt like a schlub at the end of the evening. It was just, you know, it was a bad experience all the way around. At the opposite end of the spectrum, all the way, is ChristmasMountainTrees.com. And if you want to find out more about it, again, you just go to the website, ChristmasMountainTrees.com, where it is, first of all, it's fantastic. As I mentioned yesterday, the guy, he said he was trying to err on the side of caution by saying that They might only have 85,000 Christmas trees, but it was probably more. And I swear to God, he said it without just, I mean, he was, they just, they are the greatest, nicest people there. Troy and Jennifer, who are the folks that now are running Christmas Mountain Trees, and it's been there for, you know, since the 1940 is when the family started doing this. It's an entire day's experience. You go there, you have, especially if you have kids, it really is the Christmas experience as you have always pictured it, as you have visualized it, and as you've seen it represented, you know, over the years in movie after movie, but you never really get to experience it that way. Well, this you really can. It's an entire day of going. You pick out your tree. You got your drinks. You got your hot chocolate or your cider. You can either cut. If you really want to be masculine in front of your family, and if you really want to,
and I do.
I'm just saying, if one really wants to demonstrate that that one is all that, as the young people used to say, you can cut down the tree yourself. Otherwise, you can actually just select the tree. They'll drive you around. You get on this sort of it's like a. You were talking about it yesterday. It's like this massive sort of custom-made tractor, you know, wagon thing that they will kind of take you through one stand of trees after another, and you got the whole experience of being up on top of a mountain. I mean, you can actually see, I think, Rainier and Adams and Mount Rainier from there. So you're there. You're surrounded by, you know, you've got the snow, you've got the trees, you've got the crisp air, your family's there, and you say, that's the tree right there, and suddenly it's bathed in the golden glow, and the cherubim are surrounding it, and trumpets blare, and you say, that is our tree. And then they select it for you. They take it. They can actually, they'll shake off the extra needles for you right there, and they'll bale it, which means that they wrap it up with twine. You take it home. You put it in your living room. You pull the twine off. Bam. The tree sort of expands, and it is a magical time for everybody. So you can do all of that, and you don't have to sit there and you're choking on exhaust fumes in front of a Walgreens where you're trying to pick one of, you know, like the seven remaining trees the guy has. It is an entire experience. And again, you know, if you are really into Christmas, as I am, and if you got a family, if you got kids, this is really, as corny as it sounds, there are times when, you know, those cliches are really true. And this is one of those things you do it for your kids and they're going to remember it forever. So you find out more by going to ChristmasMountainTrees.com. They open Friday, November 26th, which is this coming Friday at 10 a.m. Friday, November 26th, 10 a.m., and then regular hours are Wednesday to Friday, 10 to 4:30, and Saturday, Sunday, 9 to 4:30, all the way up until December 19th. And that is ChristmasMountainTrees.com. You can find out more right at that website. Here is Dawn Taylor.
The dust has barely settled on Ireland's $100 billion bailout deal, but the disaster has already claimed one high-profile victim.
I'm sorry, what bailout of who?
The Irish government has been bailed out for $100 billion. I'm not sure if you were aware of that.
No.
Yeah.
They no, were... I wasn't. They didn't take part in their own lottery, did they? Because that never works out.
Their banks were in trouble, so okay. So they got them some money.
Okay. The answer is eat more potatoes.
But anyway, Ireland's Prime Minister Brian Cowan announced Monday he would dissolve the current government in December with elections set for early next year. The move comes as protests sweep the country, the Irish debt rating plummets, and members of Cowan's governing coalition jump ship.
I guess it doesn't really matter, though, because we don't really need anything from Ireland. Like, what does Ireland export that we could possibly, I mean, other than, what, other than Jameson's?
It's the land of my ancestors.
Yeah, but you're not there anymore. What do you care?
Well, true.
I'm just saying, like, what does Ireland have?
They're my people.
What do they have that we need?
Well, you got the
pan flutes.
You got the Bushmills and the Jamesons. You got Irish men who are actually can be quite handsome.
Yeah, but I'm
of course
just,
some of them look like those guys in the Pogues, but others are quite.
Just gonna say you got Shane McGowan and his one tooth. We got to save.
Yeah,
I mean, it's you know.
Well, the Prime Minister labored to keep the government intact through the bank crisis, but the Green Party, which shares power with Cowan's party, indicated it would abandon the partnership after the passage of the crucial 2011 budget in December. Cowan and his party have governed Ireland since 1987, but on Monday, the Prime Minister had little choice but to step down. He said, there are occasions when the imperative of serving the national interest transcends other concerns, including party political and personal concerns. This is one such occasion.
I don't know what it is. At some point in the last 10 years or so, it seems like, you know, when I was a I'm trying not to do everything in like a brogue now for some reason, saying everything like I'm Brady Murphy. You know, when I was a wee lad, it seemed like Poland, they were sort of whipping boys joke wise. You know, where like if your idiot dad, you know, was going to make some joke about something or some you know Archie Bunker style alleged humor, he always went right to the Poles. They were just the you know they were the guys who got all the lumps comedy wise. Some point in the not too distant past, like 10, 12 years ago, it became the Irish. At least from my perspective, it seems like the Irish, they're the go-to country now if you want to mock somebody. So. It's really, they're not helping their own cause, though, with this sort of thing. But I'm going to resist. I'm going to stay above the comedic fray in that way.
And I'm sure all of the Irish appreciate that.
Not that they have not that they have, you know, like radios or the internet or anything apparently left at this point to be able to hear the show. So,
Afghan officials thought they were negotiating with Taliban's second-in-command Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour during secret peace talks orchestrated by NATO. Now it turns out that the man was not Mansour, but an imposter, rendering the negotiations largely pointless.
It was triumph the comic insult, dog.
It's not him, said a Kabul-based Western diplomat involved in the talks, and we gave him a lot of money.
That's awesome.
American officials became suspicious after a man who had known Mansour in years past whispered to Afghan officials that he looked different, reports the New York Times.
He's black.
The fraudster has now returned to Pakistan, but not before being flown to the presidential palace by NATO aircraft and greeted by Afghan President Hamid Karzai himself. The revelation comes as a severe blow to Afghan and American hopes for successful resolution of the conflict through the recent peace process. Theories abound as to the man's identity. Some say that he may have been a freelance opportunist, while others suspect he may have been sent by the Taliban as a game or even by the Pakistani intelligence service.
So it was just sort of a goof. It was just a little bit of it was like one of those Far Side cartoons where there's like, you know, where there's like a bunch of snakes that have wrapped themselves inside in like a trench coat and a fedora to try to get into a movie or something. You know, just to sort of amuse themselves at slack moments when they're not blowing things up.
Let's just send them a guy and say he's the guy.
Well, look,
let's see what'll happen.
Maybe they didn't have a bathhouse in which to relax after a good sacking, you know. So they're gonna make their own fun, and they'll just let's send Ted over and just have him pretend that he's that guy. You are listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. This is Don Taylor.
Stricter security measures at airports may be a cash cow for at least one Las Vegas inventor. A Las Vegas man has designed underwear that protects people's privacy while traveling. Jeff Buskey, the man behind the product, says his company, Rocky Flats Gear, will give frequent flyers a little more privacy. For some, the issue is TSA's new pat-down procedures. For others, the concern is body scans. Regardless, many agree flying isn't very easy these days. Whatever. It's that extra inconvenience that Buskey hopes to capitalize on. My background is electrical engineering, and years ago I worked for General Electric Medical Systems designing and building X-ray systems, he says. His invention is a special kind of underwear that he says not only blocks a person's private parts while being scanned, but also protects them from potentially harmful rays. It's been well known that the X-rays and ionizing rays in general are hazardous to cellular life and DNA, he said. He says the strategically placed fig leaf and other custom-designed inserts are made of a powdered metal that won't set off metal detectors, but will give people peace of mind. He says thousands have already been sold, and sales are only getting better. The specialty underwear is available for men, women, and children. Prices start at $10 and go up.
That's awesome. See, that right there, that's Yankee ingenuity is what that is. That is like America in a can. The there is a need. He is filling the need.
Yes.
A consumer urge emerges, and the guy fabricates a product out of the thin freaking air to satisfy it. Well done. What is his name?
Buskey.
You're going to hand that to me. I'm going to...
The company is Rocky Flats Gear.
Okay, seriously, I'm going to look into that. And there's an honest-to-God fig leaf on it. That's fantastic. So the idea is that it just blocks your junk.
Yeah.
So that when you walk now, is this then not going to make you more vulnerable to the guy coming up and getting his grope on though with your penis, you know, or whatever?
Or is this going to set something off where then you become suspicious and they put you in the also needs groping line?
He doesn't want us looking at his penis. There must be something weird with him. Let me ask you this here, Doc. I don't mean to be I don't mean to ask awkward questions here.
Oh yes, you do.
Now, I don't even know.
You enjoy asking awkward questions. Admit it.
I feel like
there's
I'm in the shrink's office. Now I'm looking at myself questioning my own motivations. What am I really doing this for?
I have no secrets. I'll ask away.
All right. You don't have any. Here's the thing. You don't have secrets. You just have embarrassing things about which I have not thought to ask yet.
Yes.
That's really it. It's just questions that I haven't really occurred to me yet. Have you ever injected peanut butter? You've got this fig leaf on your shorts made by this guy, and it blocks them from scanning your junk. Mm-hmm. But then it seems like, again, they might want to be, as we found out yesterday, sort of groping the junk to make sure that you're not hiding, I don't know, like a platoon of Taliban guys, like behind one of your testes or something. So does this mean that if you're, I have no polite way to ask this. Does it mean if you're a lady, they would suspect you then of hiding something, perhaps internally? I mean, if the theory is you're hiding something behind your sack, isn't the theory you could be hiding something, like, behind your sugar walls?
I guess. They're not doing internal probes, so...
I'm not saying they should, but I'm saying by that logic, though.
Yeah.
If the theory is that you could be, have a knife taped to the underside of your Thomas, then it seems like... I mean, I say that, and of course, then the upshot of that kind of thinking is that they will just begin groping you from the inside.
Yeah.
But it's not like that wouldn't make it's not like that wouldn't make sense given their own particular skewed logic on this sort of thing.
I have no answer for that.
Well, I still don't know. I got to figure out what the Salt Lake Airport is going to be like, because Lara said that she believes that they do have the body scan machine there. On the way there, they don't have it at PDX. So on the way there, I don't know what I would get at the airport here. But on the way back from my Christmas sojourn, which is actually not a Christmas, it's like December 13th or something, I may have the opportunity to test this underwear. I should get some of this underwear and take it with me.
If you can, in time. Yeah, you should.
All right.
You should. Are you going to wear one of your Turkish T-shirts?
I am.
The mysterious Arabic writing on them?
Okay, here's the thing. I was thinking about this last night, actually. It was just Aaron that made this observation. So I got several shirts I could wear. I got the Turkish flag, and it really is just the Turkish flag. Now, the Turkish flag has the star and the crescent on it, which represents many things. Of course, it has come to be associated with Islam as well. So I could wear that, and the great thing is it's totally plausible. There is a totally acceptable explanation for it. That's the thing that I love the most, is the really unsettling and disruptive behavior for which you have plausible deniability. Because I can just say, no, it's the Turkish. Great, Nibbler spotted it right off. He's like, hey, that's the Turkish flag.
Yeah, and my wife was in Turkey, and she brought me this T-shirt.
Just went to Turkey. I said, pick me up a little something. She brought me this shirt. Hey. So here I am. The others all just have, like, weird, scary Arabic writing. One of them is, and there is this symbol, and I forget what it's called, but it looks a little bit like a Star of David, but it's not, because the Star of David, I think, is six-pointed, and this is eight-pointed. And then it has, but it looks all messed up, because it's got, like, a thing that looks like a Star of David, and then there's Arabic writing all over it. It's like, you look at it, and your brain just does loops. Like, you can't quite figure out what it's all about. So there's that. And then, as Aaron pointed out, I purchased from geekinthecity.com a couple of years ago an item that is... It's nothing I would normally wear because it's sort of tacky looking because it's like a gray fleece pullover sweatshirt, but it's his Die Hard sweatshirt. And so it's gray fleece and then in faux handwritten, in faux blood and in like faux handwriting, it's the replica of the ho, 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 now I have a machine gun shirt that McClane puts on the dead terrorist.
You might want to avoid that.
I have to tell you, and you know the sweatshirt I'm talking about, right?
Yes, I do.
When the elevator opens, it says, now I have a machine gun. Ho, ho, ho. And Aaron created a replica of that sweatshirt, and it looks like it was drawn in blood, like, by hand. I have actually worn that through the airport security post-9/11, and it was like, I don't know, maybe in 2006, 2007 I did that. And they actually didn't bat an eye. They let me walk right through with it. So that is always that's always my go-to thing if I want to screw with the TSA guys, is to wear the shirt that says, now I have a machine gun, ho, ho, ho. And Christmas is the only time I wear that, because otherwise it gets you weird looks, and also it's kind of an ugly sweatshirt just like for its own sake. But I might do that as well, because clearly, look, I do not have a machine gun,
no, right?
I mean, I think that's self-evident. So what are they going to do? I say, as though they couldn't take me in the back room and beat me with a truncheon. Here's Don Taylor.
We should do our entertainment news.
Here is your entertainment news, brought to you by the fine folks at Castalia Language Center. You can find out more about them at PortlandSpanish.com. You go to PortlandSpanish.com. Or as Don Taylor would say, PortlandSpanish.com. And you can find out how to take Spanish classes there, and lucky you, you may end up sitting next to me, Rick Emerson. When I say lucky you, that's it's not really ironic. It's just, it's one of those things where I'll tell you this. This is exactly the kind of class that is made for me. The way that they teach you, because it's like you just put me in a class of 70 people, and immediately I'm the guy who always falls behind. And then I'm raising my hand and trying to, you know, to clarify some point that everybody else figured out like an hour ago. I feel like I'm often the guy that just sort of I blow the curve for everybody. But you go to Castalia Language Center, you're going to be in a smaller class. It's a class of no more than 8 people. You get near individualized attention, and you're going to be able to learn Spanish in a much easier way, at a much faster rate. And you're going to learn it conversationally, and so that's going to let you speak it conversationally, which is really what you want anyway. You want to be able to speak it just casually and colloquially, and you can find out how to do that by going to PortlandSpanish.com. That is the website for one of our proud business partners, Castalia Language Center. Please tell them you heard it right here. Here's Don Taylor.
So Oprah's final Favorite Things episode has happened. It was so big, it took 2 days to reveal everything that she was giving to the audience members. Among the things that the audience received, everyone got an Apple iPad, classic Sparkles boots by UGG, patent leather Sophia satchels by Coach, two $500 gift certificates to Nordstrom's lingerie department for the audience member and a friend, pies from Harry and David, Garrett popcorn in a custom tin, mini croissants from William Sonoma, a Johnny Mathis CD, a Josh Groban CD, a book, and some other stuff. Oh, yeah. And everybody got a brand new 2012 Volkswagen Beetle, which hasn't even been revealed to the public yet. They're going to debut it at the upcoming Los Angeles Auto Show.
We should revisit this story next hour. I got more to say about this than we have time for here.
Yeah. All right. Producers and crew members of the reality TV series The Biggest Loser have settled a labor dispute, ending a high-profile strike that disrupted production of the NBC series. The International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees reached an agreement this weekend with production companies Reveille, 3Ball, and 25/7 to end a nearly two-week strike. The party subsequently released a statement confirming the development. The agreement is a positive step forward for the crew of The Biggest Loser. About 50 crew members unanimously approved the agreement. Under the deal, the crew members on the show will be eligible to count their work hours toward their health insurance benefits, which had been a primary goal of the union. Starting next summer, the union members must work 400 hours every 6 months in order to secure or retain their health coverage. The current minimum is 400 hours.
I don't know why, but when you were talking about this story just now, I pictured the crew members in the theatrical union stating their grievances as mimes, where they were doing of like clutching their stomach because they felt bad and then looking sad and then pulling their pockets out and they were empty and then shrugging.
And then some other ones come in and they just do it all in song.
Yeah.
A federal judge in Los Angeles has blocked the makers of a thriller film starring Adrian Brody from using his likeness until he is fully paid for his role. U.S. District Judge Dale Fisher issued a ruling Monday blocking the makers of Giallo from continuing to distribute, market, or sell the film in the United States. Brody sued last month before the film went on sale in the States, claiming he was owed $640,000. He tried unsuccessfully to block its sale, but Fisher says Brody is likely to win the case and his likeness can no longer be used in the film or to promote it. His face appears twice on the film's DVD cover. A call to his attorney was not returned. Tattoo artist Kat Von D's pet cat, Valentine, perished in a fire that destroyed her Los Angeles home. R.I.P. my little Valentine, she tweeted, along with a photo of her hairless cat taken before the tragedy. The message was met with an outpouring of support from followers. She broke the news of the heartbreaking fire Monday morning, telling Twitter, "My house burned down last night with my cat inside." She later posted a photo of herself standing amongst the charred remains of the house and wrote, "In order to gain everything, you must lose everything."
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Longtime Hollywood publicist Ronnie Chasen was shot and killed in her car minutes after leaving a party last week to celebrate the premiere of the movie Burlesque. This is a soundbite from composer Danny Elfman, who said he was caught off guard by the announcement of her death.
Full of life and really energetic and great. And you know, it's just one of those things I still haven't quite adjusted to, like, that really happened here. It just seems impossible.
I don't think I've ever heard Danny Elfman speak out loud before.
Yeah.
I think that was actually the first time I've ever heard his voice. Now, she's not affiliated with it, because isn't that, that's a famous restaurant as well.
Yeah, I don't.
Chasen's, but that's not her.
I don't know. She's a publicist.
By the way, somebody is suggesting that when I fly to Utah that I should carry with me a copy of Catcher in the Rye and the Unabomber's Manifesto in my bag. Also, the Anarchist Cookbook. No, I'm not. And then he just says, and a unicorn. Thank you. Let's do one more here, and then we will bring things to a close for today.
Well, I know you'll be thrilled, Rick Emerson, to know that Prince William and Kate Middleton will be married April 29th at Westminster Abbey.
I'm picking up on your sarcasm.
Palace officials. Okay. The London Church is historically where British crowns its kings and queens and was the site of Princess Diana's funeral in 1997. Speaking to the media today, the Prince's secretary said the couple was largely calling the shots on wedding arrangements, but had a rather large supporting cast to give them a hand. Prime Minister David Cameron confirmed the date would be a bank holiday, giving Brits two long weekends in a row. Officials added that wedding costs will be split between the royal family and the Middletons, and security costs will be covered by the British taxpayers. I know you've been itching for details about Prince William's wedding.
Looks like you're just itching over there. What's up with your...
My arm hurts. I hurt my arm.
Okay.
I'm damaged.
All right. On that note, we'll bring to a close another exciting episode of Legion of News. Thank you for joining us on this Tuesday, November 23rd, 2010. And the Rick Emerson Show is next at rickemerson.com for the low, low cost of just 32 cents a day. That's right, one quarter, one nickel, and two pennies get you hours and hours of laughs. That is capital L-A-F-F-S. Legion of News comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good things. Dawn Taylor at the news desk, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Hagler, chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. My name is Rick Emerson. We will see you again tomorrow at noon for another installment of Legion of News. Until then, have a satisfying Tuesday. Won't you? Won't you? Bye.